Hi, and welcome to Parent Talk hashtag with Bev, a black British mother in the UK with two young adults. I'm not an expert at anything, but just sharing thoughts, opinions, and experiences with everyone else in the hope that it helps someone somewhere. So today I am joined by my girlfriend, and she gonna introduce herself to you, and we're gonna talk about mental health. So say hi to the listeners, girlfriend.
Hi there. Hi, everyone. And hi, Bev. It's so lovely to see you. It's so great to see you. It's nice to see anyone, isn't it? Because we're like so isolated.
Well, look, hang on a especially minute. Lovely to see We've you. Been Zoomed out, right? Last week, I was Zoomed out. I couldn't do another Zoom. Saturday, I just stayed in bed all day. I couldn't do another Zoom meeting or conversation. I really want to touch people. I'm a toucher. I like to touch and hug. And I can't do that.
That's lucky. I like to be touched.
Girlfriend, when we meet, don't worry. I don't care how far you are.
Save it up. Save it up for me. No, absolutely. Virtual hugs. It's been tough, hasn't it?
Yeah. Jess, I don't know if you even told people it's Jess. And what do you do? What do you do? What's
your title? Bev, my name's Jess Mukherjee, and I work in public health. I'm a public health consultant, and I work in Kent County Council. And so I'm one of the consultant teams who've been working on COVID right since last March. Yeah. You know, we've just been turning up, going on Zoom, having all the kind of, you know, having to deal with finding portaloos in the middle of the night so that test centres can open in the next day. You know, we've had all that. So, yeah, that's me. And I lead, my portfolio has got mental health in it. That's my day job, and substance misuse and health inequalities. But obviously, you know, when we were hit by COVID, you know, it was all hands to the deck, really. I've learned quite a lot about COVID as well.
More than we wanted to know.
More than we wanted to know, absolutely. I mean,
we met because we're both sitting on the Mental Health Task Force. And for people who don't know what that is, for me anyway, I started working for a charity in March with families who were in lockdown. And that's kind of where I started that journey. I have another job, which is my full-time, I never work full-time, it's a part-time job, but the work as a family support worker, we had to come up with systems to be able to connect with families who either weren't able to have laptops or Wi-Fi, who were self-isolating, or who have children with special needs, who are frontline workers, those who are on very low income, and those for whom language is a barrier to accessing information. And so I recall Citizens UK, which is part of my church is partly involved with Citizens UK, and they were asking what's happening on the ground with people. And I remember them saying, would you come to, I think SLAM were doing this emergency mental health summit in June of last year. And I came and spoke about some of the experiences that my families are having due to another barrier, a pandemic, the impact it was having on their families. And from that, I believe the birth of the task force happened, and you're part of that as well. What was your journey to the task force?
Yeah, my journey to it, because I used to work in London over 10 years ago. So I'm sort of, you know, cut my teeth in Lewisham. So it was nice for me to see all the kind of, you know, South London people posse. There. It was great. The posse and the crew. Yeah, it was great. And so my journey was, you know, as soon as COVID happened, my director of public health, he said, right, OK, Jess, you're the mental health lead. We're in a pandemic situation. You know, March, it's kicked off. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen with people's mental health? And we didn't know. You know, we didn't even know what the extent of anything was going to be. So I was part of a small little task group, little work group of people across the Southeast who were all thinking about, okay, so what do we know? What do we know about what happens in disasters? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we looked at what happened in Ebola. We looked at what happened in Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. We were looking, you know, all over what happens when, you know, what happened with flu planning, yeah. What happens yeah. when something like this hits a huge amount of people. And of course, it's never happened before. So we didn't. So, but a couple of things that we did know was, and it was really clear to me straight away, Bev, was this was we were not all in the same boat.
Right.
Yeah. That became really clear because I was very conscious that I was sitting in a lovely house in Kent with a nice big garden with trees all around me and that I had a room that I could have an office in, you know, how privileged. And I realized, oh my God, what about people who haven't got computers? Mm. What are they going to do? And then I had to think, how are people going to get their contraceptions? Mm. How are people going to go to a chemist's going to be open?
Yeah. Yeah.
How are people going to get their antidepressants? Mm. Have we got enough stock? You know, so immediately we were thinking, okay, so now I help commission the substance misuse services. Are people going to drink more? What about those people who are just tipping over? So quickly, Bev, I realised it was health inequalities were at the heart of this and real big problems. And also because I work in kind of public mental health, you know, I'm looking at the whole population.
Yeah,
there was unmet need anyway. You know, there were people who weren't getting access to services anyway.
Yeah,
and then you've got Yeah, and then I was thinking, oh my God, and the nurses, the mental health of the nurses, the mental health of the people who get COVID. Mm. And it was really obvious right from the beginning in that small little task group that I was in that I was going, well, who does most of the frontline jobs?
Yeah.
Who are the people who are having, it's not me, you know, I'm fine sitting in my lovely house in Tunbridge Wells, you know, but what, so I started talking to my boss about that. I was going, my boss, who's the director of public health in Kent, I was going, this is going to be a problem. We need to do something about it. And he went, oh, well, there's a task group looking at this on South London. And I went, oh, South London, brilliant. Love South London.
Stomping ground.
Yes. And I said, yeah, but I don't work in London anymore. I work with you. And he went, oh, well, don't just find out what they're doing and, you know, see if we can use some of that really good learning.
Yeah.
So that's how I came to the London and I was group and I was so impressed by what you guys were doing. And yeah, just it was just a privilege to be part of that and privilege to see, you know, quite old faces, actually, that I knew even from 10 years ago. Mm. And actually a little bit sad that things had not really changed very much.
Yeah. And I'm new to this whole area. I mean, I think I'm just a voice and I am working with families who do not, they haven't got the time to say that they've got mental health issues because they're just trying to put food on the table or they're just trying to get their kids to access their learning. Or, you know, I've got families who are frontline workers. They don't have the luxury of being able to sit down and say that they can't go out to work. Like, for example, one mother, she was finishing her nursing to qualify for a nurse. I mean, she was in the final stages of it and COVID hit. And so therefore, you know, she still had to study to finish. She still had to work all these 3-day shifts. She then had to go to work and be in the front line of whatever pandemic or disease was coming. She has children at home. She has an elder living at home as well as her husband. So every time she's leaving the house, there is a mental dread of what she's going into. She gets into it, she has to cope with it. Then she has to leave that and come home and bringing what she has home. You understand? Because it's not just her, it's her husband, it's the children and her mother-in-law who are all living in the same space.
Absolutely. Then and I think what her father people...
dies. Then her father dies. So she's got bereavement. God. Yeah. Mm. Then there's some issue with her studying. They're taught saying that there's plagiarism or something with the last piece of work. And that is all mental stress, as well as fuel bills, as well as, you know, oh, it just goes on. And it's
a nightmare. Layered. What people, I think, often in positions of power don't kind of get, in my experience, is that all of that triggers the stress hormone. It triggers cortisol. The cortisol is absolutely there to make you run away from a tiger,
right?
Not to sit on, which is what you're talking about. And what if you sit on that cortisol, it eats away at your internal organs and causes death ultimately. And that's what causes health inequalities. And people don't understand. And for me, getting that point across to leaders, so actually, like you're saying, it's real stress. It's it's so interesting about taking it seriously, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Like I've spoken to a lot of people who suffer from depression,
mm-hmm.
and the one thing they, and my mum suffered from depression for years. You know, it was postnatal depression in the beginning. She didn't get the help that she wanted. Needed, and in the end it became psychosis, it became year on year hospitalization. So actually not doing something right at the beginning has huge consequences, poor thing. And so for me, when I speak to people who have got depression, what they say to me is, when I go to the doctors, I have to tell the doctor what's wrong with me. I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with me. I just don't want to do anything. And I feel upset all the time and stressed. I sometimes don't feel anything at all. And then the doctor's saying, And then the doctor's saying, what's wrong with you? And I don't know. And so the conversation doesn't often get anywhere. And one of the symptoms of being stressed and depressed and anxious is that you don't want to talk to anyone. And that you can't. Often you can't, there are no words sometimes, you know. So then if we're reliant on a system where you have to describe how you're feeling when you don't know how you're feeling, it's really difficult.
And I think as well, if you don't have the, one of the things I was doing with parents when I was doing a parenting course was talking about emotional vocabulary. If you don't have the words, and or you haven't been taught the words that they identify with you, what is emotional vocabulary? Come on, you know, all I'm telling you is I can't talk to you, or I can't get out of my bed, or it's an effort to open the letters.
Because I don't know anybody born in the 1960s and before who's got any vocabulary. I'm guessing we're the same age. Actually, when we were young, just suck it up.
Suck it.
You know,
what's wrong with you?
What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you?
Exactly. What you're talking
about. What's going on?
And that we had no choice but to make that work. But there were some people we could see clearly that wasn't working for. And we used to keep our distance from them because they were like, not right. They were not right.
They were not right. Whereas we just ate, smoked and drank.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Well, I did anyway.
I did. Now, listen, what you're seeing now, the body you're seeing now is different from the body that was 2019. Only because, you know, I took control of my eating and realized, no, it wasn't even controlling my eating. I had a bio scan, and the bio scan revealed for me anyway that my body doesn't like meat. As much as I was eating it. So I stopped eating meat. So what you're seeing is my body is now adjusting to the foods that it likes. And my fat is beginning to disappear of its own volition. Yeah. And if somebody had told me that just a simple thing like that would have helped me. So I'm just, you know, do you know what I mean? There's no judgment, you know.
Absolutely. No, Bev, the advice is often very confusing. Yeah, the advice is confusing.
You're Asian. You're part Asian, or what's your heritage?
Well, my parents are from Bangladesh.
Right,
both of them.
Bangladesh.
So, yeah, and I was born in Luton.
My parents are African Caribbean, they're West Indian, they're from the West Indies. And so therefore, whenever I walk into a space, when I go to the doctor naturally assumes I'm overweight immediately, because he's comparing me to the white BMI, right? A sort of, that's how I look at it. Whereas I look at my culture and we are voluptuous women. Yes, there are some unhealthy aspects of that, but I have a denser mass than some others because of where I've come from and where I, you know. So when they say things to me that I just have to look at and think, would you say that to somebody else from a different culture? Really?
Well, it's complex, isn't it, Bev? It's really complex because, I mean, I know for a fact that, you know, my genetics, my Bengali Bangladeshi genetics is adapted for small portions, rice, fish, and by and large, famine.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then you come to, you know, my mum brought me up in this country with Findus crispy pancakes.
Yeah.
What's it?
Yes.
You know, I mean, it was great. Lights and lollies.
It's luxury. Night.
It was great. So, and for her, this was luxury.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she was 19 years old. What did she know?
Yeah.
You know, she didn't have any family. So I was overweight by the time I was 8, 9 anyway. Mm-hmm. And by that time, you know, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's tough. And then you have emotional trauma on top of that. And then you've got emotional eating on top of that. So it's very difficult. Yeah. It's very difficult to unpick a lot of that, isn't it? You know, so I mean,
I think I'm really drawn to you. Because, you know, we share something that's common, which is the fact that we can't understand. Well, one of the things that we can't understand is why our cultures won't talk about or take mental health seriously. If going by what you've said, right, that stress can kill us, all right? Yeah. We are depressed because, you know, we're stressed. We're trying to work all the hours God sends to create a future for our children. And we focus on the fact that they need to have the education. So we make the sacrifices necessary for that. And we haven't got the space or the luxury to be able to say that mental health is a big issue in our community. I know it's a big issue in mine.
My mum's culture, there's no word for mental well-being, mental health. There's no word for any of that, not even really depression. The word is pagol. The word is pagol. And that means crazy.
Same
it means thing. Crazy.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is she's crazy.
Yeah.
So there's no, and in this country, in Britain, it wasn't that dissimilar, really. I mean, we've all watched EastEnders and Dot Cotton, and she was, it's for my nerves, for medicinal purposes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so in a way, there wasn't a language around. I mean, the kids today are great because they've got like a language for everything. I mean, it's brilliant, you know, to be emotionally literate, to actually say, oh, do you know, today I'm, how am I feeling? Mm. Even to have that 5 minutes, 5 seconds even to think, to check in with yourself. All stuff comes up. Mm. And we are, and as much as, you know, you're kind of, what's your heritage again, Bev? Your West Indian.
Yeah.
West Indian, Bangladeshi, you know, for all of our different heritages, we're still here in England, right?
Yeah.
And this beautiful country is not great with emotions either.
No, they're not.
You know, yeah, you know, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, keep it in, you know, get on with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got that double whammy as well.
Yeah.
You know, so there's I think that emotional literacy you were talking about is so important.
Mm.
And then we see it, and one of the things that I do, Bev, as well, is I run a suicide prevention program in Kent. And what we see is 3 times more men killing themselves.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that women aren't self-harming. They certainly are. You know, they certainly do. But men seem to be completing that suicide, you know, and that's extreme behavior at three times the rate of women. And so we're talking about emotional literacy here, you know, we're talking about, and you know, you and I instantly drawn to each other. I mean, I remember my ex-partner, bless him, he was out fishing with a mate of his, and I knew that his mate was going through a divorce, really stressful time. They spent hours together fishing. I said to him when he came back, but how is he though? And he went, what?
They didn't talk.
If you and I had been in a room for 3 hours, we would know everything about each other. I'd know your shoe size, your children's names, children's birthdays, know everything, Beth.
The thing is, so two things, because one of the podcasts I've just done recently was I've just finished one with this young man, a black young man, who's a father, and he's got two children who have special needs, right? And one of the questions I posed to him was like, because he said his father wasn't around. And I said to him, so who do you go to as a man? Where do you go to talk about some of the things about fatherhood, looking at it from the generational aspect, for the advice that you might need for what you're about to go into, is about to get married? And he was like, no one. And I let that sit for a moment, and I was like, but I said to him, you know what, men are talking now, because there are some podcasts that I've been in, like Men Talking. There's a guy who runs this charity called Father Figures.
That's brilliant. And we've got in Kent, we've got dads, DIY dads.
Brilliant.
DIY dads, brilliant.
And I think there's another one started in Croydon with the Lavender Room 5, which is specifically for men. And I think men suddenly are realizing that they are not holding a space to talk with other men. Women, we can talk about everything, yes? Sometimes we don't even talk about the things that really are impacting us, unless it's a really close circle of people that we trust, all right?
Yeah.
But even so, I listened to what you said, and I was just like, I need to tell you about these three groups, because really and truly, you're on a journey, and it's brilliant where you are, but he has his great nan, his grand nan, who advises. But I think there is a space for men, all generations, to talk to each other and to learn from each other and to support each other. And I think that's the reason I'm part of the Mental Health Task Force, really, because I'm kind of like, I'm not interested in just talking to mash up my gums. I'm interested in having real practical solutions at the end of the day. If it means that I tell you the story of somebody who's not empowered enough to tell you their story, although it will be more powerful coming from their own mouths, but if they're not at that space, what are you going to do? You can't ignore that and make an assumption above it that you're going to put provisions in place when you haven't even done the listening. Have you heard the figures from the listening? Listening campaign.
Amazing.
It's still going on.
It's still going. Yeah, it's amazing.
People still want to talk, but more than that, we want practical solutions that if I could, was you at the last meeting? I don't know if you were at the last meeting.
Missed the last one. Yeah.
Well, NHS 111 service have now they're going to pilot, but I think it's going to come out. They're going to pilot signposting. So as soon as you call 1111, or is it 111? As soon as you call that number, the first thing they're going to ask is, if it's physical sickness, one way, but if it's mental well-being, you're going to be diverted immediately to a professional.
And we've got in Kent this thing called Shout.
Okay.
If you Google Shout, what comes up is a text service.
Exactly. Yes.
So if you're upset, and you're feeling really low, somebody will text you back.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, that engagement with, you know, kind of talking, someone at the other end of the phone for you. And the thing, when I was listening to you about this young man that you were talking about, the young father, what made what it made me think was we're all each other's advocates. You know, we should advocate for each other. Mm. I mean, and also you're, as mums, you're often bringing up boys.
Yes.
You're bringing, you know, you're creating men. Mm. You know, you're bringing up boys. And that you're also bringing each other up. We're bringing each other up. We're adulting each other through this crisis.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so wonderful to meet like-minded people, isn't it? You know, when you relate to people. Yeah. And so that made me think about how we can advocate for each other.
So how did you think, and I think that's a brilliant idea, you know, I mean, that's why I do parent talk. It is to give us the space to talk about things that I think somehow we may have lost because we've lost our extended families, or our families are dysfunctional, and not even my family's perfect, you understand? But in the imperfections, if we can at least be honest and share that, then it would help us to learn from each other, with each other, and try not to be judgmental, or to even recognize that I am being judgmental and where that comes from, and then be like, actually, I want to change that thinking. So forgive me if I come across a certain way. I'm still learning. And I think
I'm thinking it through. I'm thinking it through. Exactly. We're just thinking it through. We're muddling through. You know, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? All the quests, all the kind of all the conversations about race. It's so interesting, isn't it, when you hear it? And you, so many people don't want to get involved in the conversation. So they just let the African Caribbean community just talk about it, or let the Asian community just talk about it. It's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to say the wrong thing. It's okay, we don't mind. You know?
Well, listen, you've been saying the wrong thing to me all my life. So by being silent now, that's not really going to help, is it? You know what I mean? I think when the George Floyd issue happened, my church, everybody was running around to create a response. I mean, I did a podcast of my response, which I think I cried and was wailing more than actually trying to educate anybody. I needed to pour out the feeling of absolute anguish and hurt that I was feeling. And sometimes you just need to sit with that. There's nothing, you know, my girlfriend from church, she was like, oh, Beverly, I really would like to speak to you. And I said to her, I can't talk to you right now, you know? And she was like, that's all right. And I was like, thank you for giving me permission, but I was going to take that permission anyway. And I wasn't talking to you because I couldn't trust what was going to come out of my mouth. It's going to be hurtful because I'm carrying 50 plus years of stuff around that I've not had the opportunity to let out. So it's not that I hate you, you know, which is what I said to her when we finally spoke. I said, it's not that I hate you. It's what I hate, what the institution stands for and the way in which it's shaped your vision and the privilege that you have and you don't even know it. And it's not because I hate you. I'm speaking to you because I want to speak to you out of love, but I'm still trying to form the words. And I'm still angry and I'm still upset and I don't have the solutions. You're asking, the church called together all of us to talk about a solution. And I sat in that Zoom and I was like, I've got nothing to say. I'm here, present, but I've got nothing to say right now.
Well, it's witnessing each other, isn't it? Witnessing each other's pain, and every single person, black, white, Asian, any color, at all, anyone has got pain.
Yeah.
And we can reach out to each other and witness each other's pain. It will be different pain. It will be different.
Yeah.
But there is one experience that you get when you're not white, which is you can't hide it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't be not white. You can't hide it. You've got no option. Mm. And I remember my reaction. I remember when I was a little girl sitting with my dad watching Enoch Powell or something like that.
Enoch Powell.
And my dad turning to me and saying, they'll never really accept you in this country.
Right.
And for a dad to have to say that to his little girl, you don't want to say that to your children. Really? You don't want to say, you want to protect your kids.
Yeah.
So, and I think what's really poignant is when you know, a white person says to me, I get that. I get that. I don't have to go through that, but I get that. But I've also got pain too. And I go, okay, well, let me hear yours as well. You know, because, you know, that if people...
Well, we want to heal, don't we?
We want to heal. Yeah. And also, from my experience, is people really want to do and say the right thing. They often don't know what to do or what the right thing is to do. And often there isn't the right thing. You just have to muddle along. We muddle along with each other, being clumsy sometimes, and sometimes, like you said, sometimes you can't say anything, you've got to wait, you've got to just be around, really.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's really, I thought was really interesting about the listening experience, the listening thing, Bev, and I wondered what you thought of it, was the building of trust.
Mm-hmm.
The building of trust with each other. I remember my experiences working in Lewisham when I was looking at all the data at the time. I was like kind of quite a new public health person. So I was looking at all this data about access to psychotherapy services. And I thought, there's no black people coming into the psychotherapy services. I am talking 20 years ago, and you know, quite some time ago, maybe 15 years ago. And I thought, why is that? And then I went to visit, because there was a psychotherapy service just for black people, which I thought was strange, because it's like, as far as I remember, Lewisham was about 50-50%, you know? You know what I mean? So I thought it was really weird why there should be a special service in the first place, you know? But anyway, there was. I went along to it, and it was a porter cabin.
Mm.
It looked like a toilet.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, I wouldn't want to come here
to
have a psychotherapy set. Why isn't it in a, you know? And then when I spoke to the local people, they were saying to me, well, we don't trust people.
Yeah.
My mum never said anything much about her mental health problems, because she was really worried that I would be taken away from her.
Right. Yeah. There is that fear. It's real. It's real fit. Look, if we discipline our children and they go to school with a welt on their body, social services are called, and immediately whatever we say is not listened to, because somebody has already made the decision that you have acted inappropriately, not understanding.
And there's the trust, isn't it? There's the trust issues between people who've got power and people who feel they don't have power.
You can lock us up.
Yeah. Well, in a very real way, you can do things.
Yeah, and you can lock us up. Take our kids away. Yeah. Lock us up. Take our kids away. We're already a minority. I mean, you know, look, honestly, even the people that I know, sometimes I don't trust. Okay, you've got to demonstrate to me that you've got my best interest at heart, and that you include me in the conversation. And I need to feel that you're hearing me in that space. Now, I told my mum this. I might have said to her, look, mum, you know, when one of my relationships, it wasn't working. And I said to her, it's not working. I took her to dinner, sat her down, because I knew that she had a massive investment in this relationship, right? This particular marriage I was in, right? I was 18 and a half, I'd got married. And then by 25, that had ended. So my mother had major investments in the look of her daughter being married. She didn't get pregnant and have children outside of marriage, blah, 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 whatever that may be, right? So I took her to dinner. And I was like, and this is somebody I trust, obviously, because my mum's my mum, right? And I said to her, the relationship's not working. It's not been working for a while, and I'm going to leave. You can't leave. You have to stay. It's not an option. And that's from somebody who loved me. But I was in such pain in that relationship, and I never told her all the pain that I was in. I was just telling her the decision that I'd come to. And she was like, no, it's not acceptable. You can't leave. You're going to have to stay with him. I've stayed with your father for X amount of years and I'm still with him and blah, 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 whatever, whatever. And it's not a bed of roses. And I was like, yes, I understand that. But I've been in this for like 6 years and it's not working for me. It is not happening. And she said, if you do this, you will not have my support. So I still left. I left him.
And you were so young.
I was young.
You were so young.
And I didn't,
you know, almost. If you were my daughter, I'd have been, well, you know, you're so young. Don't get married until you're 30 anyway. You know what I mean? It's such a different kind of world, isn't it?
I mean, by 27, I still hadn't had children. And my stepfather had told my mother she needed to have a word with me because I was old and I needed to have children. So, you know, these are some cultural things that come up. But she didn't, you know, so even though I would say I trusted my mother, she still turned around and told me she would not support me. She didn't trust me. And now the relationship that I have with my mother is fantastic. But at that time, when I felt I really needed somebody who was in my corner to understand that I was not only leaving this person that I had grown up with, I was leaving a community that knew me in this capacity as his wife. And I was losing all those people. And the one person I thought that I could rely upon was my mum. And she turned around and said, she's not supporting me. And she doesn't agree with me.
And it's those times and those situations that we need our friends to also adult us and parent us. We need to be each other's parents and are advocates for each other, because yeah, you're absolutely right, people close to us let us down. Yeah. I mean, it was I had a very different situation, really. I mean, I was with the same partner for 17, 18 years. But we didn't get married. We were together.
Yeah.
But we, you know, it's a marriage. If you're with someone for that long. But when we split up, my mum just went, oh, well, you weren't married anyway. What? It's okay.
Right.
You know, it wasn't taken seriously. What I realised was she didn't take the relationship seriously.
And it was 18 years.
Yeah. And, you know, I was well into my 40s when we split up. So that's a complete. So in a way, and that's where, again, you need your friends and your support network to adult you and parent you, and
you've got to be willing to accept that. You know, I mean, I think sometimes you get to some of the, what I've been trying to do with the parents I'm working with is to try and prevent them from getting to the space where it becomes a real crisis for them, you know. And I find that a lot of the times, all right, I've been in therapy, I'm quite open about the fact I'm in therapy at the moment. I've got a couple more sessions.
It saved my life. I would say being in therapy saved my life.
Yeah. No, tell me about it, girlfriend. And I don't think people, you know what, it's not even that. There are some therapists that's going to work for you and some that's not. But it's not about the therapist for me. It's about me accepting that at this point in time, I need additional support.
Absolutely.
Where that's going to come from, I need that space. I need to give myself that space to either think these things through and try and come up with an answer that I'm going to live through, right? And I'm just using that individual on that journey. And rather than doing it all on my own, which I've done before, I'm choosing to do it with somebody. Now, some relationships I've had, they're not worked with therapists. But the families, when I'm talking to other women about who is supporting you, would you do therapy? Would you do therapy so that you can get the support from not family, not friends? No one's got an invested interest in either telling you one way or the other. You just have space for you to be able to work this out and for you to follow it through, or even when you follow it through, to have someone to talk about the follow through. And these mothers are not.
Yeah,
that's around just even thinking that they can't cope.
I think we've all, every single one of us, I think almost, have this thing about we have to be strong and we have to get on with it ourselves. I personally think it's a legacy of the First World War and Second World War.
Yeah.
That's what I think. I think it's all from that. And we've got to be strong, got to get on with it. We've got to do it. We're, you know, but really the wise person becomes wise by asking for help.
Yeah, I like that. The wise person becomes wise by asking for help, yes.
And we're, you know, and like, so today I have this wonderful conversation with you, Bev, and saw you, you know, seeing you again, it's, you know, making my, you know, making me happy. And you're my enlightenment for today. Mm. You know, you've given me enlightenment. You've made me wiser.
Well, yeah. we're on that path together, darling. You know what yeah. I mean? We're on that path together. Just to know that there's another woman out there, another part of the kin, the clan, who is looking at stuff and asking questions and being, you know, honest about, yeah, these things have impacted me, or it's impacted my family. And yes, stigma is something that exists within in our community. I did a little live IG about stigma, and I had to look up what the word stigma meant. And it's a mark of disgrace that's associated with a particular circumstance, quality, or person. And I was like, none of us are a disgrace. So why is it that we won't get the additional help? I think it's brilliant that you're working in that the field that you are, and that you're bringing real, no, seriously, don't chuckle, you know, you really are bringing a voice to a space and a perspective and a thinking to a space that hasn't been there and is not there. And just by standing in that space, you're making a huge change just by even asking the question, you know, just by networking, just by being open to learn. This is a powerful position that you're holding. And it opens the door for so many more who are willing to step through. And it opens the door for people to think about things in a different way. You know, so yeah, enlightenment for the day. Both of us are enlightenments for each other and for the people, for the doors that we're holding open and the questions. Let's hope that we never lose the courage to continue to speak from the positions that we're in. And never.
I'll take that, Bev. That's such a kindness that you've given me there. I'll take that. Thank you. I think one of the things that I do in my job is I train professionals. Mm-hmm. So I train GPs. Mm-hmm. I train psychologists. I train public health people sometimes, and. It's really interesting. I sat with a group of clinical psychology trainees, mm-hmm. and they were really uncomfortable about the subject of power. They were really uncomfortable.
Explain that.
Yeah. I'll unpick that a bit. Okay. So in Danish culture, right? In Danish, there's two words for power. Right, we've only got one, right? Okay. So this kind of two in I like Vikings, you know, I kind of watch everything. You know?
Okay, and,
you know, that's my thing, you know. And so there's two words for power. There's Kraft and Macht. So Kraft is, so Macht is what we kind of think power over. I've got power over you.
Yeah.
You know, I say jump, you go, how high do you want me to jump? You know, you doff the cap. You know, oh yes, yes, whatever you want, you know, there's power over. Mm-hmm. But then there's Kraft, which is the power with, the mm-hmm. power in your hands, mm-hmm. the power to create, mm-hmm. the power to make, mm-hmm. to be a maker. And I think sometimes it's very easy for people who work in systems, and anyone actually, to think, you know what, there's nothing I can do. There's nothing I can do to change anything.
Yeah.
But I've seen people using their power in such amazing ways, such amazing ways. You know, like my favorite one, it was this GP I met years and years ago, and he was just sick of walking over homeless people. He just got really fed up of it. So he decided to ask the homeless person, why were they sitting on the street when they clearly needed to be in hospital?
Right.
And the homeless guy said, well, you know what? I've just come from the hospital, but I heard the nurses laughing at me and saying, you know, he's just brought it on himself, these people, blah, blah, blah. Right. The stigma.
Mm.
And he just discharged himself and just went and sat on the street. Yeah. So the GP, to cut a long story short, the GP from that moment managed to go and talk to someone. They managed to get some money. Now there's a clinic for homeless people in Westminster, which is run by this GP. And some of the homeless people are working in that clinic.
Wow.
That's, you know, power in his hands, And I've so when I was talking to the psychologist, I was going, what can you do? What can you do?
Yeah.
And they were going, oh, you're right. Oh, okay. So there's two types of power. We don't have, and how we use that, how do we see ourselves as powerful?
Yeah.
And what I realised was a lot of people have had the fight knocked out of them so much through life and cortisol, you know, all of that stress, you know, runs you down. And then after a while, you just think, oh, you know, I'll just sit here. But actually, when you think, what can you do? What can you do?
Yeah.
And even if it's just having a chat, a really important conversation, powerful conversation with, you know, a beautiful soul like yourself. You know, you just think, wow, actually, you know, I feel if I haven't done anything else today, I've done that. And that's helped me.
Yeah.
You know,
and I think that's a really powerful, thing to kind of end on, that we, because I know we can talk forever. The reality is, you know, would you be willing to come back to talk to us another time if so needed?
I'd love to talk to you anytime, Beth.
You know, but leaving us with the sense that we have power. It's how we choose to use it. And even if it is just to have a conversation with somebody and you're not feeling 100%, take that call, because that by having that talk, you've taken the step of power.
You could save someone's life by having that chat.
Yeah, and even reaching out and oh, you know, this COVID is really, you know, I think that I have tried to be as positive. I'm more positive than not. You know, I've tried to be positive, but even myself gets worn down by just how I really want things to be different. I really want people to step into their own power and to try and make change. And if it's by having conversations like this that other people listen to and they get gems from, which there's lots of gems that you've spilt for us today, believe it. If we in our talking and others in their listening can change something for somebody, even if it's to reach out and have a conversation, get in touch with your services if they're in the Kent area, get in touch with the South London services that are available. We're gonna get better. We've got to get better.
We'll get better.
And we have to be each other's advocate, as you said earlier, you know, parent each other, advocate for each other, listen to each other and build each other up.
Absolutely, Beth. No, it's been lovely to talk to you.
It's been lovely to talk to you. You look, have a blessed day. Believe, have a blessed day, have a blessed week. And I'll let you know when this is all going out. And just people listening, you know, just take what you need from what we're saying, and you and your family stay safe.
And I'm so pleased, Beth, that that we're doing this on voice, so you can't see my COVID hair. I need those hairdressers to get back online quickly.
I have learned
urgency.
So many things. I've braided my, well, I've always was braiding my hair, but I've become much more, waxing has been another thing.
You're looking brilliant. I personally need emergency services.
I see the seductive shoulder, girlfriend. You don't need emergency services. You need something else.
True.
Let me stop this.